You got a quorum? Let's see. Rather than doing the minutes real quick, I'm going to take this moment here. We had a small problem on a procedural deal. When we did Representative Norton's bill, we moved it to higher ed finance, and it needs to be moved to finance, period. So it can then be moved over to higher ed through the committee process. So I moved a reconsideration of the motion by which House File 194 was recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Higher Education and Workforce, and re-refer it to the Committee on Finance. Is there any discussion on that motion? Hearing none. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? So done. And now that we have a quorum, I would like to move the minutes. Representative Norton.
Could I ask a question first?
Please.
Do I need to formally make a motion to have it passed onto the Committee on Finance now before we move forward?
I think I just did. I moved it to...
I thought you moved reconsideration.
And then I said move...
Oh, it was all done in one fell swoop?
That's correct.
Oh, you're efficient. All right. Then I will move the minutes of the last meeting.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Having read all the minutes, I'm sure everyone is in agreement that they are perfect. And all in favor of moving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
So moved. I'm going to stop with that damn thing. I will tell people I had a little bit of an issue at my remodel at home, and it's not a good thing for me to have a hammer in hand, so you might want to take that away from me. Thank you. Okay, now we need to move on to our presenters today. We have the people from the Food Science Research at the University of Minnesota. And today I wanted to bring in the university's food science for a couple of reasons. Minnesota's always had a good a stellar reputation in its food and food sciences, and it's such a huge issue for our state with the ag and how we process food, with several large food processors, and so I think it's important that this committee understand how we're changing, in some respects, changing the food that we eat and the research that we're doing and how we get there. If my memory serves me right, about 40 years ago, someone got a Nobel Peace Prize for some research they did at the university on food, and it really changed the way third world and developing nations were able to feed their populations, and hopefully we'll get another Nobel Prize out of there at some point. So having no further ado, I would like to call up to the podium, to the table, Professor or Dr. Alan Levine, is it? I think that's correct, and we'll have a couple of testifiers. I think they lost one coming from Mankato. And that was the impetus when I came in here earlier to say, let's give them an extra 5 minutes for some of the committee members, because I've already got a couple notes from members that didn't make it very quickly. And I'm going to make sure my phone's off. Ah, it's a good thing. Doctor, please introduce yourself for the record, and tell us what the university is doing in food science, if you would, please.
Chair, members, I'm Alan Levine. I'm Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences. I was previously the department head of food science and nutrition. When we named one of our departments, we didn't really rename it, but we have a tagline called the Science of Healthy Food. The Department of Food Science and Nutrition at the University of Minnesota merged in the early 70s from dairy sciences and dietetics, and became a department associated with food and nutrition, so food science and nutrition. And in today's world, as you read in the paper, I had an editorial on obesity, but the same day we were talking about biofuels and the impact it's going to have on impoverished places in the world where there's about 850 million people that don't have enough food, and if we keep on making ethanol out of corn, we may have some issues associated with that. So we have both sides that we're talking about. Today, I'm going to present, followed by Dr. Mindy Kurzer and followed by Dr. Ted Labuza. Virtually every single chronic disease that we know of is affected by what we eat, and of course our lifestyles as well. But the environmental issues associated with food intake affect our cardiovascular disease. We've all known that forever. We've heard about cholesterol issues for a long time, since the 50s and before. Bone disease, cancer, diabetes, kidney disease, liver disease, arthritis, hypertension, they're all related. And some of the problems associated with overeating have resulted in some of these diseases even becoming more prevalent. I list this because whenever I talk in front of groups, particularly with pharmaceutical companies, they're always trying to make drugs that have us eat less. There's not one reason that we eat. If I asked you in this room why each of you eat, you'd have a lot more reasons than just hunger. So I always try to collect all of these reasons. It's kind of fun when you're in a classroom asking everybody. Boredom was put up there because I remember a student saying it gave me something to do while I was studying. Keeps me awake. All of these things. And free food, if we had food in here and it was allowed to be eaten, you'd undoubtedly be eating rather than just sitting and listening, right? So we eat for a lot of reasons. What that's resulted in is this incredible change over the last 30 years. And you've heard about the obesity epidemic. So this is a summary slide from the Center for Disease Control, from CDC, demonstrating what's happened since 1990 through 2005. And what you see in the various colors is that in the light blue, look, when it's clear we had no data in 1990 on those states, but these are the prevalence of BMIs over 30. That's a measure we use, body mass index. Also, that's about 30 pounds overweight for a person who's 5'4" or taller. And you can see why we call it an epidemic. As you go from 1990 to 1995, those dark blues are 15 to 19% of the population being having a BMI over 30, being obese. And in current days, in 2005, you can see several states in the South that have greater than 30% of the population being obese. More than two-thirds of the population is overweight. So we have a problem on our hands, and it results in a lot of these diseases that I mentioned before. Even something that we wouldn't have thought about, for example, bone disease, actually, if you're overweight, bone is protected. You do better. But when you diet, you lose bone, so it becomes a threat associated with that. So there's a lot of things. This resulted in the University of Minnesota developing what's known as the Obesity Consortium. The Obesity Prevention Center is in the School of Public Health, and in our college we collaborate. The Minnesota Obesity Center is a collaboration with the Mayo Clinic, with health partners, with the university. It's funded by the National Institutes of Health. It's been around for 10 years, and we just got 5 years of funding to continue that. And then there's a transdisciplinary research grant that deals with cancer and obesity. So we have a host of things. I don't want to just say that we're doing obesity research. There's lots more associated with food. I'm just bringing that up because it's such a prevalent problem and everyone talks about it. There's a new field you've heard about: genomics, proteomics, metabolomics. Omics are everywhere. There's a journal called Omics now. Omics really means we have a lot of data. That's what omics is referring to. When we say genomics, we have all of a sudden, instead of looking at one piece of DNA, you know, we have 17,000 genes on one little chip that we can look at. What do we do with those data? Well, there's a new field, nutrigenomics, which is nutrition associated with all these changes. And you can see that there's effects all the way from DNA to RNA through the protein, the translation, the transcription, and metabolism through the metabolite. And what we're going to hear about from Dr. Kurzer shortly is about some of the bioactive food components that can impact some of these effects and can then therefore affect your health. So I just thought I'd mention before Dr. Kurzer comes up here that President Brunich several years ago initiated a series of areas that he wanted to focus on within the university. One of them was referred to as Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives. And considerable amount of money has been put into positions in the university around this effort. Right now, there's new funding coming in for grants that's going to be about $650,000 a year for 3 to 5 years if the university is in the process of formally approving. It will start grants around this area of healthy foods and healthy lives. We've been focusing more on the healthy foods part of it, less on the activity and the other parts of the healthy lives, but we will be generating some data around that area as well. So at this point, if there's any questions, I'd be glad to take them. It was just an introduction for our two scientists that have come along, professors from the university, to talk a little bit about the broad spectrum in this area of research. Chair, members?
If we come up with questions, we can always call you back. So why don't we bring up your presenters?
Mr. Chair, committee members, ladies and gentlemen, I am Mindy Kurzer, Professor of Nutrition in the Department of Food Science and Nutrition at the University of Minnesota. I've been here for about 18 years, doing research mainly on the effects of diet on chronic disease prevention. And I'm here today to talk to you about the topic of agriculture and human health, and I thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak to you on this topic. I don't need to go into detail with all of you on the health care costs, the rising health care costs in Minnesota in 2004, having been over $27 billion. But of interest is the fact that when we look at the main causes of death in Minnesota, and this is very similar to what we see nationally, over half the causes of death, over half the deaths are due to diseases that are somewhat preventable, and those include cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and stroke, and those four diseases alone make up over half of this pie. So over half the deaths in Minnesota are a result of causes that we can actually intervene on. Now, that doesn't mean that over half the expenses are directly related to those diseases, but certainly a large proportion of that $27 billion could be saved if we could somehow intervene and prevent some of these diseases. When we look at the progression of disease, most of us start out healthy. Eventually, we develop some diseases, and those diseases can lead to death, obviously. We don't know everything there is to know about the causes of disease, but certainly there's a genetic component. In addition, there are lifestyle and environmental causes of disease as well. We'd love to be able to intervene somewhere in the disease process. Now, most of the money that's been spent on increasing the life expectancy of people and reducing disease occurs at the point of treatment. And that's where most resources have gone, to developing treatments for diseases once people have them. And of course, there are lots of medications. There's some research into the possibility that food could be used as treatment for disease, but that's a very, that's an emerging area that we know very little about. And of course, there are potentially some lifestyle changes as well that might be able to be used to treat disease and minimize the impact of disease once people have them. So this is where most of the resources have gone. Now, Dr. Levine already showed you the slides about the increase in obesity, and certainly the altered lifestyle and environments that we've been exposed to have increased the prevalence of some diseases. But in addition, the development of medications have helped people live longer with diseases. And I remember as a kid hearing about elderly people who died of old age. Remember, I mean, people just died of... You don't hear that very much anymore. People don't die of old age. You don't hear about people dying in their sleep in the middle of the night, peacefully at home. People die very long, drawn-out, extended deaths with lots of medications. My own father died of colon cancer, two very, very long years of lots of medication, lots of chemotherapy, lots of depression. It was very, very difficult and, of course, extremely costly. And that's the situation that many, many elderly people are in. So What I want to talk to you about today is a different approach, and that approach is the approach of prevention. Can we intervene earlier so that people actually don't develop some of these diseases, or if they do, it takes a much, much longer time so that people have a longer period of their lives where they're healthy, not medicated, not on drugs, don't develop the disease. It would be very nice if we could extend this period of time between health and disease rather than focusing on extending the period of time between disease and death, or maybe do both simultaneously. When we think about prevention, obviously there are medications that can be used to prevent disease, and many of us are on, for example, let's say statins to lower cholesterol, so that helps prevent heart disease. But in addition, there are lifestyle changes that can be made to reduce the development of disease. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. Now, when we think about lifestyle modifications to reduce disease, one of the main ones is smoking, obviously. The greatest reduction in disease that we know of would happen if people would stop smoking. In addition, exercise is very important in reducing disease, lowering stress. But in addition, what we eat influences the development of diseases. And a number of these chronic diseases that I mentioned, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and stroke, can be reduced if we modify what we eat and if we modify the foods that we eat. I mentioned already that the major ways that we can reduce disease is to stop smoking, to increase physical activity, to improve our diet, and that includes maintaining a healthy body weight and consuming specific health-promoting foods. So what I want to talk to you about for the next few minutes are a couple of examples of the kind of research that we've done at the University of Minnesota in the College of Food, Agricultural and Natural Resource Sciences that has aimed to look at specific components in foods that may help prevent disease and the modification of foods in order to increase those components so that we can provide consumers with foods that are even healthier because they contain higher levels of these specific compounds which may actually help prevent disease. The first topic is the topic of cruciferous vegetables. This is the cabbage family of vegetables, and work that we've done at the university to show that they may actually lower risk of lung cancer and colon cancer, two very, very significant cancers in Minnesota and nationally. The cruciferous vegetable family includes cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, and watercress. And one of the reasons why this particular family of vegetables is so important is because they contain a family of compounds, very small chemical molecules naturally found in these vegetables, called glucosinolates. And glucosinolates have been shown to be cancer preventive, and these are compounds that are naturally occurring in these vegetables. This slide shows a study that was done by Dr. Stephen Hecht at the University of Minnesota. He's in the Cancer Center. And he did a study looking at lung cancer in rodents. The bar on the left shows the rodents who were treated with a particular tobacco carcinogen. So this is a carcinogen that people who smoke are exposed to. When those rats were treated with these glucosinolate compounds that are found in cruciferous vegetables, the number of rats with lung tumors was dramatically reduced. So these particular compounds lower lung cancer in animals that are exposed to tobacco carcinogens. So we have every reason to believe that the same would be true in humans. Work done by one of my colleagues in food science and nutrition, Dan Gallagher, and his graduate student at the time, Andrea Plate, showed that cruciferous vegetables, also in rodents, in rats, reduced a particular precancerous type of colon cell. And when animals were fed broccoli, watercress, and cabbage, which contained high levels of these glucosinolates, the number of precancerous cells was dramatically reduced. And in subsequent studies, in which they actually provided the rats with this isolated compound, so these rats were not given the vegetables, instead they were given the glucosinolate compounds in a more purified form, it was apparent that this also reduced the number of precancerous cells. So what this tells us is that this particular compound in the cabbage family of vegetables is responsible for the cancer prevention, that occurs as a result of consuming the vegetables. And in fact, there is subsequent work being done at the University of Minnesota by researchers on the agricultural side, in agricultural science, in the plant sciences, in horticulture and agronomy, to modify these vegetables so that they will contain higher levels of the glucosinolate compound.
Doctor, there's a question. Representative Norton?
Representative Mahoney, members, and Doctor, I'm wondering, is it, this is more of just curiosity, is there a difference between cooked and raw on this type of, with these vegetables?
Interesting question. In fact, with these, this is not always the case, but with these particular vegetables, the effect is stronger if they're raw.
Okay, and then I wondered if, and I'm tongue-in-cheek here, if you didn't try Brussels sprouts just because everybody hates them and the rats wouldn't eat them, if that's why they weren't part of your stuff.
You know, I'll tell you something. I was at a meeting where I actually said something about how everybody hates Brussels sprouts, and there were probably 40 people in the meeting, and there was a mutiny with all these people saying, I love Brussels sprouts. So I don't, do any of you eat Brussels sprouts? A lot of people like Brussels sprouts. I think of Brussels sprouts as not something that's a favorite, but a lot of people love Brussels sprouts. If they're cooked really, really well, they can be delicious.
I just want you to know that I have an absolute fabulous cook at home that loves Brussels sprouts and has cooked them about a dozen or two times different ways with everything from, he's got a spice rack that's larger than most people's book racks.
You hate them even when they're cooked well?
Even when they're cooked well.
We won't tell her, though.
She knows.
Oh, she knows. Well,
but she has given up.
Oh, she has?
Yeah.
She hasn't given up, or she
has?
Okay. The point of this is really that if we can increase these compounds in Brussels sprouts, then for those of you who like eating them, you'd actually be consuming more healthful Brussels sprouts than you already are consuming.
Well, it was interesting how you brought it up, that if they were just treated with the compounds from these vegetables. So can't you just give me a shove it into me and without having to eat the Brussels sprouts?
Well, Mr. Chair, that is...
That's the next stage of your research?
That's another approach. That's a more pharmaceutical approach. And when I'm at meetings in which we're discussing these kinds of issues, there's a tension between the food people and the pharmaceutical people, because there certainly are researchers who would like to isolate the compound and create a pill and just give it to people in pill form as an easier way to get these compounds. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work that way. When it comes to some of these compounds, they are not effective when they're in an isolated form. They're only effective when they're consumed as part of the food. In this case, the slide that I have up here shows that these particular compounds were effective in an isolated form. But that is not always the case. And sometimes there are problems with toxicity when they're given at certain levels. And so it depends on the particular compounds themselves.
It would be interesting at the end of your presentation to take a couple minutes to talk about how you work cross-discipline with other departments at the U.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will do that. I will plan to do that.
One moment, Representative Ruth, did you have a question?
I did, Mr. Chair. Dr. Kruger, just a quick question. So how much are we supposed to consume of this in a day or in a week?
We're all going to go out and buy broccoli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruth, ladies and gentlemen, the amount that you would need to consume in order to get the benefits, at this point we don't know in humans, because the human studies with cancer have not been done. It's animal studies, and the animals are consuming a lot. They're consuming the equivalent of a couple of pounds per day. of these vegetables. So, you know, I'm showing you data that are in early stages. We're not at the point yet necessarily of being able to make easy recommendations to people. It's a process, and we're partway through the process.
Please continue.
Thank you. The next topic is the topic of my research area, which is soybeans and the prevention of chronic disease. And the first topic that I'd like to share with you is that of soy consumption and some of the research we've done at the University of Minnesota to show that soy consumption lowers risk of breast and prostate cancer. The reason that we're interested in soy is because soy contains these very, very interesting molecules, daisine and genistein, which are sometimes called phytoestrogens, or the specific chemical family or isoflavones. And you can see by the structures that they're very, very similar in structure to naturally occurring estrogens, and DES is a synthetic estrogen. So these are sometimes called phytoestrogens or plant estrogens, and they actually appear to exert some hormonal and anti-hormonal effects when they're consumed, and it's as a result, in part, of the hormonal and anti-hormonal effects that they may exert some health benefits. They also exert effects that have nothing to do with their estrogenic properties as well. So there are lots and lots of different mechanisms. My interest is in estrogen and the effect of estrogens on health. And when we think about estrogen, and estrogen is important to men as well as women, although we think of estrogen as a female hormone, men have circulating levels of estrogen as well and require estrogen in circulating. But not only are the main estrogens important, and the primary estrogen in young women is estradiol, but they are also broken down within the body into lots and lots of different forms of estrogen. And a number of these forms of estrogen that we naturally break down estrogen into are thought to be potentially carcinogenic. So the 2-hydroxyestrone is a form of estrogen that is considered to be an inactive metabolite or breakdown product, while the 16-alpha-hydroxyestrone has significant estrogen activity and has been shown to stimulate cancer cell growth. So the balance between our metabolism inside, our natural metabolism of estrogens, the balance of metabolism into these two compounds, the 2-hydroxy and the 16-hydroxy, may be very important in influencing our risk of cancer. And in fact, there have been a number of population studies that have shown that women who produce more of this 2 relative to the 16-hydroxyestrogen have lower breast cancer risk. So this is thought to be a good index reflecting risk of breast cancer because these women are producing less of the 16-hydroxy, which is considered to be the carcinogenic estrogen. I've looked at, in my studies, the effect of soy consumption on a number of health endpoints in humans. I do clinical studies in which I take people and I feed them soy for different periods of time, and I take their blood and I take their urine and I measure everything that I can measure. In men, we've taken biopsies, prostate biopsies, to try to see if we are altering some of these, what we call intermediary markers of health, in a beneficial direction. And estrogen metabolites are one of the endpoints that we've looked at. And what we've found is that consumption of soy, and in my studies we've used soy protein isolate, consumption of soy improves estrogen metabolism in women, and we found it in both premenopausal and postmenopausal women, so young women and older women, in a direction that is consistent with prevention or lowering of risk of breast cancer. And interestingly, for the first time, we report, no one else has ever looked at this, we recently have just submitted for publication a paper in which we show the same effect in men. That in men, and men have estrogen just like women, as I said, and men have these metabolites, consumption of soy alters the breakdown of our naturally occurring estrogen in a direction consistent with reduction of cancer. In addition, as I said, we took biopsies in these men because they were at high risk of prostate cancer and had to have biopsies anyway. So we gave them soy protein for 6 months in between two biopsies. And what we found was a lowering of androgen receptor expression in the prostate tissue. This also is consistent with lowering risk of prostate cancer. So these are some of the mechanisms by which soy may reduce risk of breast and prostate cancer, and I could talk for an hour on this topic alone. But I will say that in the prostate cancer study, interestingly, it's a very, very small study, we found, and these were all men at high risk of prostate cancer, so they were men who had high PSA or who had precancerous condition in the prostate but did not have cancer, we found that the group that was consuming soy developed cancer at a much lower rate than the group that was consuming the control protein. And this was extremely interesting because we were not looking for this specifically, but we did find that the soy consumers had lower prostate cancer development than the non-consumers. The next topic I want to talk about is soy and heart disease risk, because these are some other studies that I've done. And we've shown, and others also have shown, but these data are from my laboratory, that consumption of soy alters blood lipids in a direction that is consistent with lowering risk of heart disease. Soy consumption lowers total cholesterol significantly. It increases the HDL cholesterol, which is sometimes called the good cholesterol, high-density lipoprotein cholesterol. It significantly lowers triglycerides, and it lowers LDL cholesterol, which is sometimes called bad cholesterol or the low-density lipoprotein cholesterol. And when you look at the ratios of total cholesterol to HDL or LDL to HDL, which are both considered markers of increased risk of heart disease, they are significantly lowered. So soy consumption has a very, very significant beneficial effect on blood lipids. It also has beneficial effects on a number of other endpoints related to heart disease, such as the health of the vascular system. These are just a couple of examples that I just wanted to show you of work that we're doing in food science and nutrition in the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences related to foods and health, specifically on the bioactive components. But there are a number of other studies that are being done. There are researchers who are looking at the effects of grape extract, dried plum, the fruit formerly known as prune, wild rice, and reduction of heart disease. Flaxseed. I've done some studies on flaxseed, which is not typically thought of as a food. It's linseed and is used to make linseed products, textiles. But now we find flaxseed in a number of breads and other and cereals. Flaxseed also has been shown to potentially reduce breast cancer risk as well as heart disease risk. Some of my colleagues are doing work on mushroom extracts and compounds in mushrooms and reduction of prostate cancer. A number of researchers in our university are looking at the health effects of whole grain consumption and what exactly are in the grains that help reduce risk. And then bee pollen, some of the products of, that bees produce, and effects on HIV, anti-HIV effects. We have a unique opportunity at the University of Minnesota. And this is an opportunity that one or two or three other universities in the whole country have, really. It is so unique to us. And that is that we can do this kind of research, and Mr. Chair responds to your question a little bit, that involves collaborations among plant, nutrition, food scientists, and economists within the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences, as well as interdisciplinary work with researchers in the medical school, the School of Public Health, Mayo Clinic, etc. In addition, we live in a state with a very strong agricultural base, and we live in an area with a very, very strong food industry. We have all the pieces in place to be able to do this kind of research, looking at how to make foods healthier to help us prevent disease. And in fact, a number of the projects that I spoke about involve collaborations among all of these folks. And I'll show you the last slide which is on future research, and then I'll talk for a minute about the kind of collaborations that we've done. The kind of research that I think that we need to be doing, the direction that we're going in, is one on the agricultural side, and that is the manipulation of the content of bioactive components in plants. And that's through selection, breeding, altering growing conditions, genetic modification, and processing. I am collaborating currently with Dr. James Orff, who's an agronomist, a soy grower at the University of Minnesota, and he has been doing research to select cultivars of soybeans in Minnesota that are particularly high in the bioactive components that we think are providing the health benefits. And in fact, he's seen about a five-fold difference in the content of soybeans in Minnesota. In addition, he's working to manipulate the soybeans by genetic modification so that we can create soybeans that are very, very high in these compounds. And then I will do the clinical studies to test these soybeans to see if they actually exert the expected greater health benefits when people consume them. So that's one example of the kind of collaboration that I'm involved with between nutritional scientists and plant scientists to try to bring together the two sides of the research question, the agricultural side and then the health or medical side. As I just said, what we need after we develop these agricultural products is animal and human clinical trials to evaluate their health benefits. And Dean Levine mentioned all of the different omics. And in this research area, we have two different types of very cutting-edge science that we're working on. And if I had realized that I would have had more time, I would have prepared some slides to talk a little bit about this. On the one side, we have the agricultural science, the cutting-edge science that I just mentioned, that may involve genetic modification, may involve selection and breeding in order to create products that are highly concentrated in the most healthful components. At the same time, we have the human side, which involves what we sometimes call nutrigenomics, which involves working with genetic differences in people. The way that plays out here is that there are clearly some people who respond to diet differently than others. In other words, we know, for example, with soybeans, that there are subgroups of people who, because of their differences, either genetic differences or metabolic differences or environmental differences, there are some people who respond better to soy consumption, who experience the benefits more than other people do. And that may be genetic. I'm involved right now in a grant. We're submitting a grant to look at green tea and the health benefits of green tea. And green tea contains a family of compounds called catechins. Now, some people break down catechins very quickly, and other people don't. And that's a genetic difference that we can actually measure. We can take blood, and we can measure it to determine whether you're a high breakdown or a low breakdown person. What we are theorizing is that people who break down these very beneficial compounds very quickly don't get the benefits. This is a genetic difference. And that's what we would like to test. We would like to do studies where we recruit people on the basis of their genetics in order to try to determine if these genetic differences influence the responsiveness of the groups of people to diet. And this is again a cutting edge area of nutrition and food science in trying to determine, to identify people who respond better. Because ultimately, what many people think, what many professionals, medical scientists, research scientists predict, is that we're moving towards an era of individual dietary recommendations instead of the very broad dietary recommendations that we have right now, that we're going to have enough information on individual genetics that we're going to be able to break people at least down into categories of types of genetic profiles, if not into very, very individual genetic profiles, such that we can make recommendations and say, you should be consuming fish oil because you're going to benefit from it, but you will not get any benefit. So I
should be eating a lot more steak and potatoes and...
Brussels sprouts.
And broccoli.
Chair Mahoney, you might be one of those people who needs to eat steak. I'm not sure. Well, that, it may take a while. I may call and invite you to participate in one of our studies.
I don't know that I'd make a great test subject here, but... I'm going to stop, and I've got a couple of questions, and I'm going to open it up to questions because I always open myself up to ridicule here. It's a good tool. But my question, we have a huge food industry, and you alluded to that in the state. And do you, does our food industry connect up with our university a lot? And if so, how do they do that? Is it through exchanging scientists, or having them come in and work in your labs? Are you going and working in their labs for a while? How does that work with the university and our food industry? And I was just off the top of my head going while you were talking. I think there's I could come up with four or five of them here in the state.
Chair Mahoney and members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. There is quite a bit of interaction between researchers at the university and the food industry in Minnesota. For example, we have a faculty position in food science and nutrition, which is called the General Mills Chair on Healthy Foods or Nutrigenomics. We consider it a nutrigenomics kind of chair. So General Mills was extremely interested in helping us pursue this research area of nutrigenomics and actually have endowed a faculty position. And there are other faculty positions that have been endowed by Cargill, I believe, as well in the same area of food and health. There are faculty members whose research programs are supported in part by funding from the food industry. Some larger companies, some smaller companies. So they support our research. We graduate students who go to work for a number of these companies. And so many of the companies in Minnesota hire students, graduate students and undergraduates who are trained at the University of Minnesota in the areas of nutrition and food science. So there are many, many ways that we connect. Some of our faculty members take sabbatical leaves and spend a year working with a company in order to make connections, get some experience, exchange ideas. So there's a lot of exchange that goes on.
Do you, feel free, one more question. Do you work with the Ag College, seems how it's in the name, to try, you spoke to the idea of breeding and manipulation of plants so that these plants, our farmers can grow more high-value crops that would benefit us, so that I could actually get the benefits of Brussels sprouts without having to eat them?
Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, so your question is, are we doing that work right now?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are. And so the example I gave was the project I'm involved in with soybeans, mm-hmm. in which I'm working with a soybean researcher to develop more healthful soybeans. And I have colleagues who are working on similar projects with the cruciferous vegetables, the Brussels sprouts and broccoli, to try to breed cultivars that will have higher concentrations of those healthful components. So that research is being done at the University of Minnesota in the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences.
Thank you. Representative Haas?
Thank you very much. Just somewhat academically, I'm curious if the research that you're having is on our food crops. In some past cultures, even today, we have populations that use the native plants for medicine and have for centuries. Is there any research being done with the native plants?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hawes, ladies and gentlemen, yes, there is research being done on some native plants, on botanicals within the college, within the Academic Health Center. I'm less familiar with that, but I do know that there is research being done, much less, in part because the funding for that kind of research is much more limited. The funding for research on native plants, on botanicals, is limited. And so there is some research being done in that area, but not as much as in the area of the bigger crops.
Mr. Chair, Doctor, I think one of the areas that we should be concerned at is when we're wiping out native populations, is that we're losing plants that we do not know the value of their existence. We sometimes kind of just shrug that off. It's just a loss and it isn't worth much. But the worth much has not been determined yet, or has been determined and forgotten. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Representative. Anything to add there, Doctor?
Nothing, except my last little line of the presentation was just that obviously you already alluded to it, Mr. Chair, and ladies and gentlemen of the committee, that the final end product of all of this work will be the potential marketing of value-added products for disease prevention and agricultural products.
I'm a big guy with add-on value to products that we make in the state of Minnesota. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for inviting me, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I'm Ted Laguza. I'm in the Food Science and Nutrition Program. I have been at the University of Minnesota since 1971. Could have retired. I have three young children, one of them a freshman here at the university, and two at SPA. So
can't retire yet.
Can't retire yet. I've got a lot of... I'd like to see the tuition go down, but I don't think that's going to happen.
You got a couple bills to sign around here, then.
Well, unfortunately, my middle son, who's graduating from SPA, is going to Columbia next year. So I'm going to be
a part-time job.
Yes. What I'm going to try to answer some of the questions that have been asked and how we operate. One of the interesting things that Dr. Kurzer pointed out is that we are in a major city and we have a huge food industry. I mean, I think before Pillsbury was bought by General Mills and Grand Metropolitan, we had 8 major companies in this state that were in the top 50 companies in the United States in terms of food processing. So we have a great relationship there. What's even better is that in the food science side of our program, about 40% of our graduate students are working full-time and getting either a master's or a PhD degree. And I'll give you some examples of that as we go along. I'm going to touch on several projects, both from the standpoint of food quality and food safety, to answer some of the kinds of questions that you've been asking. So well, I'm going to address it in terms of what's the problem. As Dr. Kurzer pointed out, many active components in natural, what I call nutraceuticals, and that would be herbs and botanicals, the question that was asked by you, Mr. Chair, degrade during storage when they're dried. What has not been done very well is what can we find markers for this efficacy that cause the loss? Analytical methods to determine how good the products are. There have been a number of studies published showing, for example, with St. John's wort that they were out in the marketplace and they had nothing effective left in them. And most of the work that I've been doing is looking at the function of temperature and humidity on degradation of these products. I've also done a lot of work in the area of loss of protein quality in dry and semi-moist foods, and I'll point out one project that Dr. Davis was going to talk about, isn't there? So, for example, this past 9 months, I had in my laboratory a scientist from Brazil who was interested in a number of botanicals, very beautiful flowers that are being used by native Indians in Brazil for very specific purposes. And the question was to find out, you know, what was the active ingredient there, and with the method of drying it, we wanted to commercialize that, could these products be stable and still, you know, be used by people not out in the wild, but in there. So that's the kind of work that we've been doing. Dr. Bott is from the Process Pharmaceutical Labs in University of São Paulo, and this, for example, is one of the studies that we looked at, showing that at 65% relative humidity and 34 degrees centigrade, a fairly abusive condition for the state of Minnesota, especially at this time, but not too uncommon in Rio de Janeiro, that almost 25% of the active was lost within 1 month of storage. That says something about what we need to do to try to protect the product. And she, fortunately for her, she left the first day it snowed in December at the end there, so she didn't get to expose herself to this kind of weather. One project, and again, going back to answer a question you asked, what do we do with industry? The food science program within the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences has a lot of support through the food industry. This project on the storage stability of dry protein bars. The protein bar market is about a $1 billion market in there. Nabisco and Lori Davis, who was supposed to be here today, got stuck in the snowstorm down in the Mankato area, so she could not make it. They have funded us. In fact, this work is her master's thesis that she completed a year and a half ago. Nabisco has had a long history with our department. Two of the sons, there's five children in the family, two of the sons were undergraduates in our food science program. I've worked with them for the last 35 years. They were here when I first came here. Lori was a Canadian. She was recruited here for the diving team, and in fact set some NCAA diving records a number of years ago. Went to work for Nabisco. I got her a job there. She decided that she should get her master's degree, married one of the boys, and now is the director of research. And they've taken their company, that was basically a company that made cheese curd, selling it to Kraft for making Velveeta cheese and things like that. And in my working with them over the years, about 15 years ago, I said, what you need to do is to take the whey protein, the whey solution that they were dumping, and create something out of it. They have one of the most modern facilities for separating proteins and making very specific special proteins from this. And one of the projects, for example, funded in the department is a protein that lowers blood pressure. One of our nutritional faculty members is working on that project. My job that they gave me and Lori did for her thesis was the problem that in these bars, over time they harden, and the protein reacts with the sugars. If you look at the colors of the bars from left to right, that's bars made with whey protein on the left side, which they would like to sell, and substituting 20% at each bar going over to soy protein, which they'd rather do it with whey, and you can see the whey protein gets very dark. You don't see that because it's covered by chocolate in the bars. But the quality of the protein goes down significantly, and so we've been looking at the hardening, how to prevent it, and how to prevent that reaction that takes place in it. And that project, actually, we have funding from DMI, which is the checkoff money that comes from the United States government in terms of the 5 cents per hundred weight of milk, and from the Minnesota Dairy Association, which is part of the dairy companies here in Minnesota itself. So this is one of the projects that we're working on in terms of trying to improve the quality of the product. What did I do?
This is a technology committee. You can probably get some help.
Right, yes. One of the things that we have found, in fact, in the last 3 months, is that by substituting, instead of soy, substituting hydrolyzed whey, one of the products they make is they take the whey protein and chop it up with an enzyme to make it into smaller pieces. And the scale on the left is hardness. We lost the words when it was converted from iMac over to the PC. But you can see that using the WH3, we could reduce the hardening by a factor of almost six times over a, this is 7 days at 45 degrees C, which is equivalent to 3 months storage. And so we are finding solutions for improving the quality of these products and improving their nutritional value. Those are just two very simple things that we're doing on the food quality side. We're doing many other things. What I'd like to focus on is the food safety problem. One of the critical issues, and you've heard the problem with, we had recently with the Taco John down in southern Minnesota, Taco Bell out in New York, Pennsylvania area, listeria problems that have occurred every now and then. Listeria is an interesting food pathogen. Both Dr. Diaz and the department and myself have done a number of projects in this area. Listeria should be killed in the processing of things like hot dogs, of hams, of luncheon meats. But moving the product from the cooker to the packaging room, maybe 100 yards, there's listeria in the environment because it's a very unusual organism that can grow in cold conditions. Most pathogens can't. We use a lot of water to keep the plants clean. The cleaner we make the plant, the bigger the listeria problem is. And it can get on the surface of the hot dog or whatever. And so Hormel was interested in finding a process that could be done after the hot dogs were packaged to make it safe and still maintain the quality. And so what the director of research was a good friend of mine, Forrest Dryden, did is he took the guy who was going to replace him as the next director of research and moved him here to Minnesota, Minneapolis, to then get a PhD degree and work on this problem. And one of the things that he worked on was using high-pressure processing, one of the most unusual processes around. First worked on at West Virginia in 1898, never commercialized, and about 7 years ago, a company commercializes. You imagine you look on the left-hand side, you see those two white cylinders. That's a basket that you can put packages of hot dogs or meat in, and you can lower them down into a barrel, or actually it's a gun barrel, about 10-inch thick walls. You lower the basket down, fill it up with water, seal it at the top, and then it's hooked to these pumps that are on the right-hand side that pressurize that chamber to 80,000 pounds per square inch. That's three times the depth of Mariana's Trench. If you put a submarine in there, it would be crushed. Okay? Doesn't do anything to the hot dog, meat, stuff like that, but it kills the bacteria. The problem is that you can't put a pressure gauge inside there to measure the pressure, so you don't know whether the package has reached the right pressure in there for the right amount of time. And what Dr. Meinerich, who got his PhD for this work, paid for solely by Hormel, came up with a little copper penny that shrinks in size and you can measure that size shrinkage and exactly tell you what pressure is inside the chamber itself. Very, very interesting. There's a set of data. He used that data then to look at the kill of Listeria so that he could have the right kind of process itself in there. So it is a real, right now Hormel has six of these pressure pumps going. And almost all of their deli meats that go to supermarket chains is processed by this technology. They are a leader in that field in the United States. Another thing that creates problems in terms of safety is the distribution chain with temperature abuse. This is a study done by FDA. I've also done one study. I chose to show the FDA study because they had more retail stores. They measured temperatures in cabinets where meats and where dairy products were taken, both in the home and at retail level. The red line is the line. If you're above that line, you've got a safe condition. If you're below that line, you've got a potential problem for growth of pathogenic bacteria. 25% of retail stores are out of compliance, and for long enough that you can get the growth of a pathogen in there. So what do we do to solve that? Well, it's even more difficult because some pathogens like Listeria can grow at refrigerated temperatures. Most of them survive that. And so what we need is some information about the time temperature history that the product goes through and put some kind of date on the product that would be based on safety. Dates on food products are not safety-based. FDA and USDA now has put together a proposal for looking at this from the standpoint of safety because they think that's a very critical issue. Oh, one of the pictures didn't show up here. I didn't see this on the thing. This is a plot of the shelf life of fresh cut salads. Mike Doyle, who is the leading food scientist, food microbiologist, has stated a number of times he would never eat anything that was pre-cut green salads in there because of the potential for this abuse that occurs in the distribution chain itself. The higher the temperature, the faster the salad spoils. So what we have is a balance between the potential for growth of the pathogen to an infectious dose versus the growth of spoilage bacteria spoiling the food. What we would like to be able to do is have the food spoil before it gets bad from a safety standpoint, because then you could use your nose as a critical tool for evaluating. Unfortunately, that doesn't occur because these organisms have different growth characteristics. And in my laboratory, what we've been doing is trying to get data so that we can come up with a way of setting some type of shelf life date based on this type of thing in terms of refrigerated foods. So we are doing studies, for example, with hot dogs, with inoculating them with Listeria, and then trying to determine the growth rate under different conditions. This is just some of the data. What we're going to use this data for is something that, to show you another interaction with industry, I have taken two sabbatical leaves and two quarter leaves with 3M Company. Now, most people don't realize that they are in the food field. They are through a number of different divisions, microbiology and packaging systems division. And one of the things that I worked on there and actually have a patent with them during one of my sabbatical leaves is a little tag, which they're not selling, which they could. There's a little tag that if you look at the bottom there, bottom right, that white bar over time moves from light to dark. And so eventually has the same color as the outer circle. We designed chemistry inside that tag that responded to time temperature history in exactly the way a microorganism would, that would spoil milk or that would spoil hamburger. We could do the same thing in terms of products that would be pathogens. So we could have a tag that would be based on safety in there. There's enough movement in Washington now to say this is something that's needed. But even better is the fact that we can do this electronically with time temperature tags that have temperature sensing, logging it. And I've worked with a company in my last sabbatical, which was this last year, for 9 months, was working with a number of grocery chains in Europe on time temperature history of some of the products they were distributing using electronic tags and little handheld devices where you could walk through a truck or walk through a warehouse and you could see the tags were on individual cases. You could see for each case it would bring up a little graph and it would tell you what fraction of shelf life was used up. And so you could now change the distribution instead of first in, first out, to the least shelf life left, first out. And we actually did a study with distributing fish, catching fish off the coast of Greece. That was a hard thing to do. In a commercial boat, shipping it to a supermarket chain in Italy. They used to have 15% shrink. In that case, we used chemical tags because we didn't have all the readers ready for it. But they were able to eliminate the shrink completely. So we get better quality food to the consumer, and we can get safer food if we tie this to some type of shelf life dating for the food itself. Third area that I've been quite involved with is bioterrorism. One of my students, who owned the Green Giant Fresh Vegetable Distribution business, did his master's for me. He was the first student I had that worked full-time. He worked at Pillsbury. He got his master's for me. And then he was going to go on for his PhD. He got promoted too many times. They sent him to Haagen-Dazs to be the VP of Research and Marketing there. And then he retired and lived in California. And then Pillsbury hired him to come back, but he set up his own company to distribute fresh greens, like broccoli and cauliflower and lettuce, Brussels sprouts, stuff like that. He set up his headquarters here in Minnetonka, and he came to me one day and says, you know, Ted, I want to come back and finish my PhD. I got people running my company. And so after some pushing and shoving and getting the right doors open, he began to develop a computer model for distributing his lettuce. And in that model was, if it was infected with a food pathogen, a food safety thing, you know, where would lettuce show up that would poison people? 5 days of shipment, 900,000 heads of lettuce all around the United States. Okay. Pretty serious model. That model we used with a number of other people to get a $15 million grant from the Department of Homeland Security set up a national center for food safety in terms of food safety and protection. Okay. One of the things that I did in that is milk. Milk is a very vulnerable system. Milk is very important in this state. It's a large and concentrated operation. There's four companies that have about 80% of the milk supply, fresh milk supply that goes into our children's mouths, into all the restaurants, into all the schools. There's a total lack of security in the system. In the plants now, the big plants, like here, the Schroeder plant here, they put the security there. Where the security is lacking is at the farm. There is a state law, and Mr. Elfering is here, so he knows. He's head of the inspecting, one of the inspection groups within the Department of Ag. The state law that says you can't lock your milk tank so that the sanitarians can take a sample. That makes that milk tank vulnerable for somebody putting something into it that then could get through the system and cause a bioterrorism event. So that was one of the things I had to do, was to evaluate this whole milk system. It's a very complex thing. This was supported both by the Department of Ag and Homeland Security. What I created, and you can't read that because it's not a secret, but it is a secret. It's a model we developed that if you put X grams of a toxin into a farm tank or into a tanker truck, how many bottles of milk, how many containers, half pints, whatever, would show up with a toxic level in it. And we also had to evaluate whether or not the pasteurization would inactivate the process. This is one scenario for a milk. You have a milk silo at the plant. You've got different trucks coming at different times. This is the third truck coming in during the day. And what it shows, this is for a plant that's producing milk for the school lunch program. What it shows is that in the between the 8.5 to 35 hour period when this milk was dumped, there's going to be 330,000 toxic containers that are out there. And that's a real critical problem that we face. How do we get rid of it? We can try to inactivate it. One of our projects that we have been working on is inactivation of anthrax spores. I won't try to explain this graph, but this is some of the work we've done. USDA published some data showing that anthrax spores were very easily inactivated. However, in the middle of their paper, they put a statement, which was very weird, that said, don't trust any of this data. We don't think it's any good. which was interesting. Published in a respective journal. And that's the upper blue and yellow line. Our line is the red line that's in there. And that's the real line, the red line. We show that you have to go to fairly high temperatures. This work was, again, done with Dr. Diaz and a postdoc of ours, Dr. Zhu. What it said, you need about 120 C for 15 seconds. The unfortunate part is that the typical pasteurizer, that we call them the plate and frame pasteurizers, can't operate at that condition in a plant because the rubber gaskets will blow. But there are ceramic gaskets that are available that could be used for doing something like that. So we could have a safer supply if we went that. This information is gone. We've presented at a number of dairy meetings and talked with the dairy industry people on doing something in this area. We've also done some work to show that under those conditions, if done right, adding green tea flavonoids to the milk reduces the burnt flavor that you get developed with this process, and you can't tell the difference. So here's another use for a functional ingredient in there. The last thing I want to talk about is something that we've only done in the last 2 years, and that's the question of safety of grain. Moldy grain, corn, wheat, barley, whatever, can have mold grow on it that produces various types of toxins. One of the most significant ones is Aspergillus mold that can produce something called aflatoxin. Aflatoxin in high concentrations will kill, but it's present in very low concentrations. And it's not in all the grain. It develops in pockets, so you have a very, very difficult time sampling as a boxcar. If you take 6 samples and they're all negative, you cannot say that there's no aflatoxin in there. Aflatoxin in low levels is a major carcinogen. It's considered one of the major natural carcinogens in the system. And I was lucky one day flying back on a plane sitting next to Mike Yost, who is a president of a company in Blaine, at that time called Thermo Electron, and they designed high-speed equipment for using x-rays to see whether bottles or cans had metal or glass fragments in them for the food industry, doing 800 cans a minute. And he says, you know, I'd like to do something with the university, and so we had some sessions for 6 months to come up with some ideas, and what we came up with is a device that could be used at the silo level, either incoming to the silo or going out, and we're only in the early stages of this, that would use fluorescence detection because these toxic compounds fluoresce, and it would be, the grain would be flowing by, and you would have a sensor, and if you got fluorescence above a certain level, then that grain would be diverted and not go into it. The idea is not new. Old Dutch, and I worked with them 30 years ago, developed with Philips in Eindhoven in Netherlands, developed a process where French fries would be flying by in a tube going through something that looked like a tire. And in that tire, it had a bunch of cameras that took a picture of every French fry going at about 45 miles an hour. Okay? And it quickly determined how much black spot was on the outside of that French fry. And it was above a certain level. That was a reject. Before, they used to have a line with 20 women picking the potatoes, and they would do pretty good. In the morning, they only the finished product only had about 0.5% black spots on the potatoes, but 8 hours sitting there picking potatoes went up to about 4%, 5%. This camera system does it down to about 0.1%. So this would be the idea that we could divert this grain and not have it going into the food stream and make our foods much safer. Aflatoxin costs the country about $1.5 billion in terms of lost product that had to be recalled and things like that, or grain that was too moldy. We would like to be able to divert it from the system itself. I'll stop here and take any questions you have. And let's cheer for the hockey team next week.
Are there any questions for Professor? Let's fire. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's been an interesting discussion about what our university does and how it relates back to the industry and our food industry in the state of Minnesota. It is a large industry here, and the research really does help. And I appreciate all the hard work that you do.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Any closing comments from the committee? Seeing none, I think we will be back here tomorrow. With that, I will adjourn the committee. Thank you.